Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. And we have a special event going on here today. We've got more guests than just about any time we've ever had here. Of course, we have Sue Majeure, my sister, as a co-host. Welcome, Sue.
I'm glad to be here. It's an exciting episode.
Absolutely. And then we have Gary Heilig. Gary, thank you for being the Garden Guy.
I'm happy to be Garden Guy.
So. All right. Did you have that name before you came on this program?
No, I've been called many names, but that's not one
that's
of them.
That's not one of them. Okay. Well, we were going through the history of good growing, and it's interesting. There's been two Garden Guys and two Garden Gals. And anyway, hey, we have a special guest today. We have Ruth Calkins. She is a lifelong gardener with both commercial and household gardening, and you'll get to hear her story as generationally from her grandfather to her father as they traipsed from New Jersey to Florida to South Carolina to Michigan. So there's a longer story behind that. But Sue, would you lead us out with a word of prayer?
Yes, certainly. Heavenly Father, thank you for the privilege of being able to garden and grow things. After all, it was the very first duty that the Lord gave us in the beginning was to be gardeners. And so he knew that it would satisfy us, keep us learning, and teach us about him and help us to grow closer to him. So we thank you for all of those benefits that it gives us and for our program and our special guest. In your name, amen.
Amen.
Well, Sue, not only do we have Ruth Calkins, but we also have David Bulduck, the president and founder of Strong Tower Radio, and he is here to share the rest of the story.
It's good to be here.
Thanks so much, David. We really, part of the story cannot be told without you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Ruth. You're a seasoned gardener, and tell me a little bit about your gardening history, that generational, that started with your grandfather as a florist in New Jersey.
Yes, it was near Plainfield, New Jersey. My grandfather had greenhouses, two huge greenhouses, and then several smaller greenhouses. Most probably you would think of them as large, but we thought of them as the smaller greenhouses. Grandpa grew flowers for the New York market. And as a little girl, I would climb up the ladder behind my dad. He worked for my grandfather in the greenhouses, and they would pick sweet peas. He would cut them, and then my mother would bunch them to send them to market. But my dad really had love for growing vegetables, not flowers. So I remember that he would plant tomatoes in the greenhouse. He would tie them up. And I remember so clearly how he would snap that string so they would pollinate. Oh, we had the best tomatoes you can imagine. Yes. And of course, they grew flowers outside as well. And my dad had a large, large greenhouse. And he sold tomatoes, especially tomatoes in New Jersey and pepper and that type of vegetable to the market. And I remember him taking all those things to the market. And as a little girl, I had to be helpful. And those ugly tomato worms, oh my. Yes, we had to pick them off the plants. Yeah. And planting tomatoes, we would carry a bucket of water, and Dad had a tin can nailed with a long, nice handle. And we would have to put one whole tin can full of water on those tomato plants when we planted them so that they would have enough water. Yeah.
Well,
it was fun growing up.
I can tell you, that sounds like work to me.
Oh, yeah. Picking the tomato worms was the work. And then when the tomatoes grew, oh, they were so good to eat. And I just loved them. But Dad was very particular about his product. And the bigger tomatoes had to be on the bottom of the basket. We had to wipe every tomato with a cloth so they look like a picture. And the wholesaler would wait for my dad's produce because they never had spoilage because we had to put up the perfect produce. Yeah.
No,
product was perfect.
I want to ask Gary a question. What is the difference of the mentality, the thought process between a commercial grower and a home gardener?
Well, you have to remember, a commercial grower is depending on that money for their livelihood. So this particular grower was one that wanted to have the best on the market. And I always used to teach people, that's what you want to do. And when we went to farmers markets, I always told my wife, we take the best, we eat what's left.
Yeah.
In a home garden situation, well, people will have different levels of what's acceptable. For instance, some want things looking perfect, like a commercial grower. Others are a little bit more tolerant of defects that would not bring a very good price if you were selling it.
You know, I heard somebody say this a number of years ago on the radio. He asked the question, why are the best strawberries in New York? And I think you've already hinted that is you send your best product to get the premium price.
Yeah, but I've tasted strawberries from California, and I'm telling you, makes me want to cry. We can't get strawberries that sweet in Michigan.
Well, let's get back to Ruth. So you were in New Jersey, and then something changed. You moved south, in fact, down to Florida. How did that happen?
Well, Grandpa sold the greenhouses. He sold the business. It was time for him to retire. He was almost 80 years old. And so it was time. And my dad really didn't want to live where it was cold. And he had to use all his nights firing those furnaces to keep the greenhouses warm. He wanted to move where it was warm. So we moved to Florida. And then Dad farmed there. And he grew for market, mostly lettuce and cabbage. That type of thing. And then there was a doctor in Florida who treated his patients often nutritionally. And so Dad grew sweet potatoes and greens. And the doctor especially liked the sweet potato leaves from the plants for his green drink that he nourished his patients with. And so Dad did that too. And he grew all kinds of vegetables, but his main crop for market was lettuce and cabbage.
Now, that only lasted for how long?
Till Highway 4 took our house. And so if you look on a map and see where Highway 4 goes, right on the property where we lived. And so then Dad moved to South Carolina. Mom and Dad moved there, and he farmed there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He built a greenhouse on the back of, what we called the shed. And he grew plants for market in the spring, and he grew pimento peppers for market. That was his main commercial crop, pimento peppers.
So how long was
he? He grew other things as well. Oh, yes. Oh. For local markets.
So sounds like a bit of diversification. When you say commercial markets and you say local, what is the difference between commercial and local?
The local market would be like a fruit stand or a vegetable stand that people, you know, people have a business and they sell fresh things in season, and Dad would grow for that. But commercially would be like a big factory that needs lots of pimento peppers to can. And so then there's a lot of that.
Oh, so two food processors, largely canners,
right,
and such.
Right.
So how long did he do the South Carolina growing? It seems like there was always a greenhouse in your family.
Not in Florida.
Oh,
yes, okay. Not in Florida, but yes. When mom and dad lived in South Carolina until their health. Their age, they needed to have help. And then my husband and I built an apartment on our house so they could live with us and we could take care of them. And that's when Dad came here.
Okay.
And Mom too. And my husband was, yes, he was a gardener and he was a farmer, I guess you could call it. Yeah. Now he liked cattle too. And haying and that sort of thing. But he also had a huge garden.
Well, good. And I have a question for David. David, let's talk a little, turn a corner and talk about Good Growing with the Garden Guy or its predecessors. Was it always called Good Growing with the Garden Guy?
No, actually it wasn't. But early on, when we started making application to build the first station, WGCP, Jim's dream was, and he passed away unfortunately in 2008. We didn't go on the air till 2009, December. But his dream was to have a program where he would give me a list of questions. Sound familiar? And then I would ask those questions to him, and then we would have that interview back and forth. That was his dream to have. The equipment, broadcast equipment, and to store it was in the back of Ruthie's father's 1960 International pickup, which it's still running. We're working on that. And, you know, just so much of what she's saying is a direct connection, like you're bringing out to her parents, her grandparents, and Jim with their desire to use the time and opportunity of in the garden, but also to have an opportunity to share the gospel. Ruthie didn't mention this, but when her parents were living there with them, they would sell some plants, and they would have a sign out front that said, closed on Saturdays, closed on Sabbath. Ruthie can tell you more about that a little bit. But there was always an evangelistic effort in this to bring the gospel into the garden, to teach people more about the love of God through plants, through garden, but also Jim's desire was to take that to the next level through radio.
Wow. Gary, you've been listening to this story largely the first time. We gave a little outline previous to this, but can you give some commentary on this family experience of growing commercially for local markets and for household goods? Is this typical, or this the way it used to be, or?
Well, it really depends on the person. I mean, there are people who grow commercially, as was mentioned earlier, but then they will also sell locally on a farmer's market right at their farm. Or, for instance, in the Lansing area, there are lots of outlets for people to take their produce and sell it in the community, which would be considered local. We have many farmers markets in that area, and there are more markets than there are growers to go to all of them.
Really? Really?
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of commercially now, if a small grower wants to get involved with, say, somebody like Myers or Kroger's, there's so many hoops they have to jump through, it becomes more realistic for them to do direct marketing. And
that is fruit stands?
And yeah, stuff. Fruit stands, going to farmers markets. But also, you could have your own little food club, sort of like what Great Lakes was doing, where they would grow certain things and people would buy shares in it, and then they'd get something each week. Some people can do that too.
Sounds
like
good.
Your own version of HelloFresh.
Yeah, HelloFresh, yes. Local is good.
Aren't those called CSAs, Gary?
Yeah.
CSA stands for community.
Hold on a second. I don't remember right now.
Hey, that was your quiz question for today.
Yeah, well, then I failed that quiz. Cause, you know, over time, you start to forget stuff, and I don't remember. I used to talk about CSAs all the time. Well, I'm drawing a blank right now.
Hey, Ruth, before we go to the break, would you just talk about some of your fall, I call it Farmer's Almanac advice. What Farmer's Almanac advice do you have? You never plant before Memorial Day and things like that?
No. Oh. See, when I married Jim, it wasn't long, and I had to have a greenhouse. And so he built one on the back of the house, and I sold plants. Just, you know, here for people to buy, to come to the house and buy plants. Well, that starts your season. You plant, okay, I have a calendar example. This and it can't be absolute this hour and this minute, but it's within these days. So March 28th, I start my pepper and eggplants. Seeds, plant them in a flat and to get the seeds going. And then about the 4th of April, I start tomato seeds. And then about the 12th of April, I start the cabbage type seeds. And when they have the seeds, then I transplant them. That's about, you know, and then as far as putting them outside in the garden, depends on the weather. I always like to check when the full moon is, because often there's the frost at the full moon time, and so you want to watch the weather before you put your tender plants out.
Yes, I have a dear friend that about a week ago, he left. He got away with two near freezing temperatures, and the third time with his aloe vera, it didn't make it. It had a few years of growth on it.
Oh, yeah, you have to watch the weather. And you don't want to plant before it's time, but you don't want to wait too long either, because then you won't get a crop. I always like to order seeds in January, because, I don't know, the catalogs come and I like to order seeds in January. My favorite catalog is the Baker Creek catalog.
Yeah, that's a nice catalog.
That's a beautiful catalog. It's just worth getting to look at. Well, folks, we're going to take a break here. We're having good growing with the Garden Guy and the Garden Gal here on Strong Tower Radio. We'll be back after this break.
Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
So, Ruth, what are the blessings of having a garden?
Well, I think the greatest blessing is in gardening. It's something working with God, and you get to know how He blesses you. And I cannot even begin to imagine God's great variety in His imagination. All the varieties of tomatoes and then vegetables, even you name it. There's all these varieties, and they're so tasty. And there's so many lessons you learn from gardening about God. I have taught children, see those weeds? They're like things in our character that should not be there. And it's the grace of God that pulls those weeds from our characters. So we learn a lot of lessons from working in the garden. We can't send the sun to shine on the plants. We can't order the rain to fall. We can't do all these things. But God can. You take that seed, that bean seed, and you put it in the ground. One bean seed, and how many beans do you get? Wow. What a provider. It teaches us what a provider God is. And the vitamins and minerals that get in those vegetables and fruits and make us healthy. So you can learn a lot of the blessings of God in gardening.
Tell us, if you're a commercial gardener, you need to be efficient or you won't make the profit that you need in order to sustain your operation and your family. What are some of the things that you do to be more efficient when you're growing?
Well, here's a little thing that you can do that makes it easier. Let's say to plant beans or corn. Well, for me, bending over and putting those seeds down, those beans like 1 inch apart or 2 inches apart or however you want to do it. Take a PVC pipe with a diameter of maybe 2.5 to 3 inches. Screw a handle on the side and make the pipe about the right correct height so it's comfortable for you with that handle. And then you just, in the row, you just plop the seeds down. Now, I prefer, for myself, hill gardening. So when I plant beans, I like plant five in a bunk. There they go down the pipe, the PVC pipe, right into the ground. And I put five, and then I go maybe 15 inches and put another five. It makes it so much easier to hoe between when you have to get rid of the weeds that way. I do that way with corn. I put three and then go with space and do three. It just is easier for me. So, yeah, I do that. And I like to have a good hoe and a good dibbler when I'm transplanting.
What is a dibbler? So
it's a little tool that you use to make a hole when you transplant. It's... how would you describe it, Tom?
Gary,
it's pointed.
Okay, it's a single point.
It sort of looks like an upside down nose cone on a rocket.
Okay.
When you just punch a hole in the ground, it makes the hole for you to put the seed. It's real simple for you to do that, and then you can just cover it over. I just use my finger a lot of times because I till my garden so well. It's nice and ready to, my fingers the dibble.
You know, I think if you want to do the spacing between things, you could put it on a board and put multiple of them, and you could do them all.
You could do that.
Something like that. Also about your idea of the PVC pipe, Could you do top dressing of different minerals and count mid-season by just dropping it in?
Well, the thing that you have to remember, you don't want your fertilizer in direct contact with the seed, especially if you're using quote unquote chemical fertilizers. If it's organic, it won't burn the seed, so you won't have a problem.
Well, for instance, last night I put down bone meal and
yeah, that won't burn the seed,
and also Epsom salt. So
yeah, no problem there.
But I was thinking it would be easier. I was bending down over and over again to directly place it. Good idea.
I'm always thinking of ways so I don't have to do a lot of bending over because it's rough on the back.
That's right. Well,
I like my PVC pipe. It's right handy. I used it to plant corn.
Mm-hmm. And the older you get, the more you look for things like that. Because
that's the truth.
If I sit down in the garden, it's a little bit more work to get back up again.
Well, listener. Well, listeners, you've heard that tip here. That's Ruth's tip for the day, and that's your takeaway. Any experiences that you've had over the years, that stories of growing that you kind of told that in the history of your family growing, but any stories you stand out in maybe a year that was of great success or maybe a year that wasn't quite as good?
Oh, we've had years, yes, that were really, really good in Florida, though. Oh, my. Florida can get a freeze there in the Orlando area. And I can remember several nights when Dad would come in and the temperature was down and he'd have to go the next morning and plow it under and start over.
That's tough.
This is fun. But here in Michigan, you can have really good crops. Sometimes I have grown and there's so many tomatoes that you have to beg people, please come. Otherwise, they're going to go to waste. Because how many can you can? You know, So, yes, some years we've had the best crops. I can remember when Jim planted about 15 rows of corn in our garden, and we had people come and enjoy that corn. And that's the fun of it, when you can share those groceries and people know how good they taste. Yes, yes.
Well, I'm sure that our listeners are looking forward to our a quiz this month. Gary, would you like to share some of our quiz? I understand it's on onions.
Yeah, onions.
And my sister pleads ignorance on this particular one.
Well, here's the first question. What do onions have to do with the Olympics?
It has something to do with the logo. I don't know.
No. Sue, you want to hazard a guess?
They recently had the Olympics in Beijing, and China grows the most onions, I bet, because they grow everything. So maybe it has something to do with that.
No. Ancient Greek athletes ate pounds of onions and drank pure onion juice before the competition. And if it was a close race, I'd probably want to go back anyway with all those onions that they ate.
Okay. Oh my.
Here's the next one. Why do onions make you cry?
I have no idea.
Isn't it the sulfur, the sulfides or sulfurs?
Yeah.
Irritates your glands.
Yeah, when you slice them, they actually release sulfuric compounds. One of them is sulfuric acid. And, of course, that causes you to tear up. But if you want to reduce that, just simply put your onions in the refrigerator for a little bit or slice them while the water is running in the sink. And that'll decrease that. It never bothered me that much. But if you're a person that's older and you have dry eyes, hey, I welcome an onion that makes me cry. Okay, number three. Which onion has the most antioxidants? And I'm talking about color onion.
It's got to be either the yellow or the red.
Yeah, because basically we have white, yellow, and red onions. We're not talking. We're talking bulb onions
here. Color, I think the more color, usually the more antioxidants.
Well, so you'd
I'm
be wrong.
Guess yellow or red.
You'd be wrong on that one, Sue. It's the white onions. Wow. But when you cook it, it reduces the amount of antioxidants drastically. And an antioxidant is a compound that reduces oxidation, which is a chemical reaction that causes what they call free radicals to be loose in your blood. And I don't want to go any further than that, because when you start talking about free radicals, you're talking about molecules and valences and all those sorts of things, which would put most people to sleep. But let's just understand this. Free radicals, bad.
Okay.
So, and they can get involved in a lot of problems like inflammatory diseases. They can play a role in getting cataracts, cancer. So you don't want free radicals. So when you hear that a vegetable is high in antioxidants, that's a good one to have for health. All right, how much do you think the world's record onion weighed? Recognized by the Guinness World Book of Records.
I'm going to say 30 pounds.
That's a bit high. I'd like to see a 30-pound onion, but the biggest one has been 10 pounds, 14 ounces, so just short of 11 pounds. That was pretty.
Wow.
All right, you'll love this one. What nation worshipped onions and buried their leaders with onions in their, I won't say what they call the coffin, because that would give it away.
Wouldn't that be
it's
the Egyptians?
Because you remember the Israelites complaining about not getting their onions and leeks and melons.
That's
from
right. That's right. The
Egyptians.
Can you imagine worshiping an onion? That's a messed up society. Okay. What herb, if you eat this herb, will help you to get rid of onion breath? I'll give you a hint. It's green.
Cilantro.
Parsley.
Parsley.
Absolutely correct. Parsley. I'm going to have to try that. I'm going to say, okay, Jess, I'm going to eat this onion, then I'm going to blow some breath in your face, and then I'm going to try the parsley, and you tell me what you think. She's going to tell me what she thinks before that experiment is even tried. Okay, the next one is, can dogs eat onions?
No, they're poisonous.
That's
well,
right.
Toxic. They're toxic to dogs and cats. I know this because I used to be a vet assistant.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But no, a dog should not eat onions, specifically not fresh onions. I don't know if that would change if it was cooked or not. But what it does is causes problems for the red blood cells, which can lead to anemia. And in severe cases, it can kill the dog. So you have to watch out for a weakness, vomiting, loss of appetite, dullness, breathlessness. And if that happens to your dog, you might want to check and see if he's been in the onion bag. And then the last one is, what is the most popular onion color in terms of production?
Yellow?
Correct, yellow. It accounts for 75% of the world's production. And onions are the sixth most popular vegetable that's grown based on production.
Wow.
That's amazing.
I found out something. Here's one to dazzle you, Gary.
Okay.
I'm easy to dazzle. I was really surprised by this because I would never have guessed it. Which race eats the most onions?
It's in the Middle East. Libya.
You're right. Can you believe it? Seriously. Every person there eats an average of 66 pounds of onions a year.
Yeah, they knock those onions out. But, you know, in a lot of Indian foods, they have onion-based sauces, and they use a lot of onions, too. Mm-hmm. Now, you might ask Gary, why does he know such a weird thing? It was a question on one of the quizzes in the past.
I am not that smart.
Well, Gary, we need to turn a corner because we want to get in most of things. We were really glad to have Ruth with us this time. But what is the fruit of June?
The fruit of June.
Fruit of June.
Strawberries.
Strawberries.
Yeah.
You go to Big Boys, and they always have that strawberry whatever festival or whatever.
That's right. Yeah, strawberries. Oh, and going back to when I said California strawberries were so good, I was talking about when you go there and get them when they're ripe, not what's being shipped here, because they're not fully ripe. But the sugar levels was nothing I've ever tasted in Michigan or anywhere else. But anyway, usually strawberries come in about the second week of June. And so a lot of times there will be strawberry festivals built around that. And it's one of my favorite times. And I like to get my strawberries if the robins don't get them, because they love to go down the row and pick holes in them, which really burns me up. I wouldn't mind it if they just take a berry and run off somewhere, but no, they just taste every little berry for the ones that they want. And but I would warn people, and I've talked about this before, that we have a fruit fly in Michigan that lays its eggs in ripening fruit. Remember the spotted wing Drosophila? And if you're not spraying your strawberries and other soft fruits, I guarantee you, you're eating strawberries with maggots inside.
Ooh.
Ouch.
They're very small, but I don't prefer meat with my strawberries. So be sure that you are spraying, and there are a number of organic things that'll keep them under control. You can use neem, and there's some others that can be used that'll keep them out of under control, but you'd have to spray them about once a week.
Let's transition. You segue into spraying vegetables. I really don't like spraying, but you're almost convinced me.
Well, the thing about spraying is there are other ways to keep things off of your plants. We normally either spray for disease problems or we spray for insect problems. And insects you can keep off of certain things by barriers. And I've talked about using row covers for leafy greens or cabbage, things of that sort. And you can even use it for broccoli if you have a large enough row cover. And if an insect can't get to the produce to lay an egg on it, then it doesn't become a problem. But if you've ever grown broccoli, for instance, and you haven't been spraying for the imported cabbage worm, there's nothing worse than, and this happened to me in a restaurant once. I had some soup and it had broccoli, and out came a little caterpillar.
Well, let me ask you this question real quickly as we go into the break, that how long you can have row covers to is a barrier. How long do you have to do it? What once too much? I did it once. And
well, row covers are better for things that don't have to be pollinated.
Okay.
So you don't have to pollinate cabbage or broccoli or leafy greens and those types of things. But if it's, say, strawberries, the row cover will also help heat stay close to the ground, and so it will actually cause the fruit to ripen a little sooner than it normally would. But that row cover has to be off of the strawberries during the time that the bees are working the flowers. Otherwise, you're not going to get any strawberries.
Well, going back to the carnivorous plants, can you leave it on the whole time, or does it have to have sunlight, direct sunlight?
Well, the row cover allows about 90% of the sun to come through. So, for instance, I have grown, and I've talked about this before, I've grown cabbage where I would plant the cabbage plants, I'd put a little ring around the base so you wouldn't have cutworms, then I'd put some newspaper and some straw on to protect from weeds, then I'd drop coffee grounds down that would take care of the slugs, and then I put the row cover on it, and then and I would have a drip hose irrigation, and all I had to do is water it.
I like that.
No spraying, no weeding, you just wait for the cabbage to get ready and you're done.
All right.
There's a lot of upfront work, but you don't have to do any spraying.
One time.
Growing it that way.
Great. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back for the last section of Good Growing with the Garden Guy.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
Here we are with Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We have the Garden Guy and we have a guest garden gal today. That's Ruth Calkins and Gary Heilig and, of course, Sue Majeur and yours truly. Hey, Gary, is pruning still possible on your fruit trees?
Yeah, you can prune fruit trees into June. So it is a little bit more difficult to see because you have all the leaves out. But yeah, and I have some pruning still to do.
So Gary, on my three of the four trees that I have, apple trees, have wonderful blossoms. One that is clearly over 100 years old, as I'm told. It looks like a good year. Does that guarantee I'm going to have fruit this year?
If you see bees out there pollinating the trees,
okay,
then yes, you will get something. And have you guys had very many frosts up here or freezes?
That seems to be constantly.
Well, by now, now are you in past bloom yet? You should be past bloom up here.
John is saying yes.
Okay, so you can see the developing apples. And as you go out there maybe once a week, the apples grow very fast at this time of the year. And so anything that's not progressing, that's going to go off on June drop. But anything that's continuing to swell, then you know you're going to have an apple this year.
Okay. What about ornamental pruning and brambles?
The reason I put that in there, lilacs are blooming right now and some of the other flowering shrubs that are early spring flowering shrubs. So if it blooms before early June, then you prune it just as soon as it's finished. Now, the reason you do that is because the flower buds will develop late summer into the fall, and then next spring, if you prune it before they bloom, you're going to sacrifice some flowers. And that's okay if you want to do that. But if you want to keep the flowers, you wait until after they're finished blooming.
It seemed like the white lilacs are the most fragrant this year for some reason.
Well, French lilacs are the best in terms of fragrance. Common lilacs, you don't get as much of a smell. And speaking of flowers, let's talk a little bit about butterflies because people are planting things right now. And I put this in there because it's really nice to have things in your garden that attract butterflies to the garden. And we have a lot of butterflies in Michigan and skippers. And so you can look up what a particular butterfly likes in terms of flowers for nectar or what they like to feed on. And what butterflies, like any other animal, need is they need food, water, and shelter. And for instance, they like flat stones in which to rest. So you can put a couple of those in your garden or a very shallow water pan so they can get something to drink. But you don't want it deep enough to where it sits there forever and mosquitoes can lay eggs in there. And then, of course, they need nectar sources because the adults feed on nectar only. And then the caterpillars have to have various types of leaf tissue. So if you want some good nectar plants, they include things like Mexican sunflower or sulfur cosmos or narrow leaf Mexican zinnia, gonferna, heliotrope, French marigolds, lantana, moss verbena, fragrant phlox, and various asters, very brightly hued asters. Those are all good nectar plants. And that's just a small example. So you can look up other examples on the internet. And then they also like to have something to feed on in terms of plants, which would be things like Joe Pieweed. Painted Lady likes something called Cudweed or Everlast. Dragon Sagebrush, Parsley, Dill, Fennel, and Carbon Rue. Common root, and that'll attract the black swallowtail, for instance. And then wild black cherry in the area, or milkweed, goldenrod, all these things will attract different butterflies that will eat the foliage. So, and they don't necessarily have to be in your garden. You can have the plants that they like to feed on, like the monarch likes to feed on the milkweed. That can be just somewhere in the yard or even in a field nearby. But then the other flowers that have the nectar will attract them into your garden. And it's really nice seeing some unusual butterflies because you have made the habitat possible for them to do well.
Can you get mixes that are of seeds that...
I'm sure you can. I would look under some of the nature societies or go online and search for flower seeds to attract butterflies. If it's out there, you'll find it without too much trouble. I'm currently collecting information now because I plan on making a series of videos on just that and also on attracting hummingbirds to your yard.
Well, you might as well tell folks about your YouTube channel.
Yeah, just go to Gary Heilig on any of the search engines and it'll take you to my channel. It's going to take me a while on these because the more I do the research on it, the more details I'm finding. So I'm trying to decide how I want to do this. Do I want it general or do I want to do a series of videos on how to track specific butterflies to your garden? So I haven't decided that yet.
Always something to learn.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to put this to practice myself.
One thing that really grabbed my attention that I'm interested in following up on, successive planting or succession planting.
Well, the reason
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, the reason we do successive planting is I remember a community garden we were part of, and there was a young family that planted their first garden. And they planted about a 25-foot row of leaf lettuce. Now, even if you're a vegetarian, you're not going to eat that much lettuce because it all would come out at the same time and be ready to consume. And as you know, lettuce is not something that you can store. You can't freeze it. You can't dry it, any of those things. So successive planting is where you select a row where you want to grow something, and then you just plant a little bit that you think you're going to use or if you're going to sell or whatever. You wait a couple of weeks, sow again, wait a couple more weeks, sow again. That way you will have a harvest all during the season. And you can do this with just about anything, spinach. You could do it with radishes or any of these things that don't take a long time to produce, but it's something that you want to have throughout the season.
Sweet corn? Can you do it with sweet corn? So it doesn't all come right at the same moment?
Up to a point you can, but you have to remember how long it takes for that sweet corn to go from seed to harvest, and you have to watch the calendar. Otherwise, you'll have sweet corn that's still growing in the fall, and then we get cold weather, and it'll never finish ripening.
Tell us a little bit about vegetable compost weeds.
Well, weeding is one of the most enjoyable things that we do in a vegetable garden. And I always think a lot of people just throw the weeds away. But when you think about it, what a weed does is take nutrients out of the soil. And where are those nutrients? In the weed. So when you take that weed and put it in a compost pile and it breaks down to the most basic essence, which is what we call humus or compost, and those nutrients are still there unless you've had an uncovered compost pile, and as it rains, those nutrients will wash down into the soil. So you can take that organic matter and work it back into the garden. So I try not to waste anything because any green material would be useful in the garden.
Some people always want us to talk about lawns. So lawn fertilizer, what if we miss the Memorial Day fertilizing?
Well, the first thing I want to talk about lawn fertilization, you have to decide how important is it to you. Because we're paying about 2 to 3 times as much for fertilizer as we used to.
And you heard it here first.
Yeah, it's the prices have really gone up. So you have to decide at what level of maintenance you want your yard. A lawn is not a natural thing in nature. If you plant a beautiful lawn and you don't put these heavy inputs of irrigation and fertilization into it, then it will revert back to what I call a diverse community of plants. And so we have to do a lot of things like control certain weeds, fertilize to keep the plants nice and thick so that weeds can't grow. But if you want to do that, What you want to do is start around Memorial Day. We tell people the ideal times to fertilize would be around the holidays, like Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, that type of thing. And if you miss Memorial Day, just put it on a little bit later. And what one of the things I've talked about is how much do we put on? And it depends on what type of lawn you have. For instance, if you want that beautiful Kentucky bluegrass lawn, that's a higher maintenance in terms of the amount of nitrogen you need for that lawn compared to, say, a shade-loving lawn, which is more low maintenance because of the kind of grass that's in a shade-loving lawn. You fertilize that about half as much. And so when we're talking about fertility, we talk about how much actual nitrogen am I going to put on? And we don't normally want to put on more than one actual pound of N per 1,000 square feet. So what does that mean? It means that if I'm using urea as a source of nitrogen, that's 46% nitrogen. So I'm going to use a lot less than, say, 10, 10, 10, which means I need 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet in order to get that one actual pound of N. If it's an organic fertilizer that's only 3% nitrogen, you're going to use a lot more. But it will last longer because it will convert to a usable form more slowly.
I noticed that you talked about post-emergent crabgrass, and it's been a whole year since we've discussed this. You'll have to refresh my memory about post-emerging crabgrass.
Well, pre-emergent means that you're putting down something before, so that the weed doesn't germinate or the product is able to kill it shortly after it germinates. So, for instance, corn gluten meal we've talked about before. It's in, what is that stuff called? It starts with a C. I'll come back to it if I remember it. But anyway, the corn gluten meal, Concern is the name of it. Okay. That little bingo ball finally came up.
There
but anyway, Concern has corn gluten meal in it, and it can be put down before the crabgrass starts to germinate, which would have been when the forsythia bushes, which make those yellow flowers before the leaves come out, that's when you would have put that down. You can still put it down afterwards, and it will kill some of the crabgrass, but once you reach a certain point, it's no longer able to do anything. Now, post-emergence means that once it's out, it's something you can apply that will kill it. Now, most commercial products have arsenic in them. I'm not all that thrilled about putting arsenic in my soil, even though arsenic does naturally occur in soils. But there is a product, if you're inclined to use it, it's called Tenacity, that will kill crabgrass post-emergence, without killing your other grass. If you do not want to use chemicals, and a lot of people don't because they have pets and the kids like to roll around the grass, then the best thing to do is use the cultural thing so that you can improve the quality of your turf so it's nice and thick. And if it's thick, then the crabgrass doesn't have any space to grow. And a lot of people mess up because they put their lawnmower level down low. And when you do that, more sunlight gets to the surface, which means more dandelions and crabgrass can grow. So I tell people, set your mower on its highest height, which is usually 3.5 to 4 inches, and mow the lawn at that level year round. And then, of course, fertilizing your lawn will help to thicken it up also. And you can either use organic or non-organic. And by the way, when you use Concern corn gluten meal, it does have 10% nitrogen in it. So you're also feeding the lawn in as addition to preventing weeds from growing.
Will corn gluten meal help the prevent crabgrass in your garden and not cause any deleterious?
Yeah, we use it, and it's a benign material because it's a byproduct of when they process corn. It looks like corn meal, and you use it at about 2 pounds per 1,000 square feet, so it's not very much you have to use. And my wife said, well, can we use it in the strawberry? She said, yeah, it's labeled for lots of different things. She put that stuff out there so thick, and I said, yes. That's just a little excessive. So, and I told her the ramifications of that is she put on a very high dose of nitrogen because there's nitrogen in it, and she's probably going to have soft strawberries, because you don't want to give strawberries high levels of nitrogen in the spring when they're starting to produce.
What about...
But there won't be any weeds.
There won't be any weeds. What about moving houseplants outdoors?
And a reason I put that on there is I have a lot of things that I'm moving outdoors, and I've waited because it's been kind of cold. And tonight I might have to haul in my avocado trees and my lemon tree that's full of lemons, because we're going to get down the mid-30s. But when you're moving things outside, they've been used to a much lower level of light. And if you just put them outside in direct sunlight, then you're going to cause some serious damage. So what you want to do is put it in the shade. Like on our front deck by the front door, we have a Norway maple. So I just put everything under there and leave it there for a week. After a week in that shade, then the cuticle layer, which is a waxy layer, will thicken, and the plants can take direct sunlight after that.
Now, I just have a question that along the sunburning or whatever. I had the greenhouse, then I also have a germination chamber inside of it. When I took it out of the germination chamber, I thought I was okay, but looks like I got some sunburning when just taking it out and putting it in the outside garden. Was that wrong?
Yeah, if you grow something in a greenhouse within a greenhouse, then the level of sunlight is much lower, and it has, like I said, a thin waxy layer for protection. And two things happen. One, it causes the plant to dry out more easily. And two, it's like getting a sunburn. So it has to thicken that layer in order to protect that leaf. So that's why you take it out of the greenhouse and then you put it in the shade for about 3 or 4 days. I've been able to do it in 3 or 4 days, but I usually tell people a week, depending on how shady it is under that tree.
We are coming into the last couple of minutes in for a landing. Any thoughts that you want to slip in there before we leave?
Well, one of the things I was doing this week was maintenance on my rototiller. And one of the things I did was I checked the gear oil in it, and that stuff was black as tar. And so it's not something that most people think about, but the transmission has oil, a gear oil, and if it's not changed, probably not as frequently as you would for engine oil, but probably every 3 or 4 years it should be checked to see if the levels have gone down. But especially if you have leaking seals around the wheels, the level's going to go down, and those things need to be checked for the level. But when it starts to get dark, it's time to change it if you want to keep your transmission. And I have a Troy Belt tiller, so that's a pretty big investment, although I didn't pay for it. If you want to keep it, and they can be 20, 30, 40 years old if you maintain them, and you should check those things.
Well, that concludes our program for Good Growing with the Garden Guy. It's been a pleasure. Ruth, we're glad that you were a part of our program today.
Thank you.
And as always, Gary Heilig.
It's been fun. We'll be back next month.
That's right. And also Sue Majeure. For Strong Tower Radio, I'm Tom Majeure. Bye now.